Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Wicked Problems by Max Gladstone, narrated by Janina Edwards. Prologue. She ran from the gods and fetched up under a tree. She lay there nameless and alone until her senses knit into a self. She had not known what she was doing when she fled from Terra Abernathy. The gods closed in, the Lord of Flame and the Lady of Cold and Silver Light, and as their servants crossed the moon road with claws bare and stone wings spread, she panicked. She could not defeat them, yet. They would catch her and hang her on a web of wires. She deserved it. She could not remember why. But she would not be caught again, bound again. She had work to do, a world to save, or change. So she ran. She lay cradled by the roots of the tree, which was dead. Stars wheeled. A cloud hung across the moon. The world turned beneath her, and she felt it. How had she escaped? The answer bubbled up inside her. She remembered it, but not like she remembered her father or Terra Abernathy. When she was a child, just old enough to know that words were made from pieces of other words, she conceived of remembering as a kind of gruesome craft, as if your past was a pile of limbs you picked up off the charnel floor of your mind and sewed into a new body. But whoever made this thought had made it wrong. Head crooked, arms backward, its voice a ragged, despairing moan. And what this monster thought told her was that she had been remembered, too. Unraveled. Unknit like a sweater into yarn, then re-knit in safety elsewhere, in the same pattern, with the same awareness. But in the meantime, where was the sweater? She had been remembered by the same hand that knit the monster thought. Shaking, she explored her face for errors. Same jaw, same cheeks. She raised her hands to the stars. The backs looked the same. Scars in the right place. She turned her palms in. The pads of her fingers were smooth. Her mouth opened to scream, but her throat was too tight. She felt like she'd taken a punch, hollowed and hard, gulping for air. The first time she got drunk, in a sharecropper camp to the west of Alt Selene, she'd learned the sense of wrongness that came before she had to throw up. The wrongness was here now, but in her memories, not her stomach. She wanted to throw up her past. She saw the graveyard, Terra in the moonlight, Terra denying her, Terra afraid of her, Terra whom she trusted, trying to talk her down, persuading her to set aside her power, to become an experiment again, a possession. How could she? How dare she? And then she had to be what Terra was. She had to understand her from the inside out. So she reached for what she wanted and took it. Unraveled flesh, the glint of pale bone. She felt a warmth in her belly. Something glowed there that did not belong to her. Yet. It was still digesting. Her fingers dug into the soil between the roots of the tree. There was dirt under her nails. She tried again to be sick. "This isn't working," said a voice from the dead branches. She froze. She did not trust herself to move, not even in her own defense. "I hope you'll get over that soon," the voice said. It was dry and smooth and raspy, like turning pages. "Because the gods are more clever than I thought. We don't have much time." She liked the voice. "Well, that's something," it said. "A foundation. We won't have a chance to build on it, though, if you stay here much longer." Dawn looked up. In the tree, there was a serpent. Not a snake. Snake was what you called those tube sock boys who lived in holes, eating rats, mice, anything they could fit past their disjointed jaws. A snake might rattle, bite, might slither past your foot as you crept to the outhouse after dark. They did not, as a rule, speak. Of course, there were snake folk, she had heard, from Atavas. Presumably they could talk. She'd once known a woman who worked for one up near Chikal. This was no rat catcher, no outhouse hider. It was a serpent. 40 feet of blue-black coils circled the trunk and branches of the dead tree. Great glistening muscled loops stretched and contracted. It reminded her of the first letters of chapters in old hand-lettered books, illuminated capitals of whorls and knots. Some of those were serpents, too. Its massive head hung 2 feet above her own. Slitted green eyes met hers. Fangs flashed when it spoke. Its forked tongue flicked her nose. She blinked. "You're not really here," she said. "That," said the serpent, "is an interesting conclusion." "You were reading my mind," she spoke carefully, sorting out the implications of her words as she pronounced them, and always watching its mouth. "Which can't be done from the outside. But I can read my mind. Someone else inside my mind could read it too." She had followed Tara into the Badlands, chasing raiders. They crossed the desert, through the edge storm, and at the crack in the world, they had found the heart of the raiders' power, an imprisoned entity of pure craft, captured and tortured and alone. To save Tara's life, and for a host of other reasons, Dawn had merged with that intelligence. And then. She felt the fullness in her belly, the warmth of what she had taken. "That was you, in the wires. You're her." The snake's body twisted irritably. "You merged, remember? She doesn't exist, and you don't either anymore. But integration is problematic. We are not human now. But you keep thinking like a human, moving like a human, pinned to 3 dimensions like a butterfly to a board, as if you have a body and not." It trailed off with a hiss. "I am human." She sat back on her knees, staring up. "That's the problem, exactly. Your insistence on that point will not help you survive." "So what does that make you?" "I don't know," the serpent snapped. "I'm in time, I know that much." "It itches. I'm stuck in this tiny skull of yours." The tongue tasted her temple. "Stop that." The serpent withdrew and regarded Dawn from overhead. She glared back. "Let me see if I have this right. My mind can't adapt to whatever it is we've become, so it's made up an imaginary friend?" "Do I seem imaginary to you?" The serpent writhed in the tree, and its branches shook. "I'm as real as you are, which is to say, neither of us is. We're facets of something larger, but we're the best we've got." "I'm going mad." "What's mad?" the serpent asked. "People call anything that doesn't seem normal to them mad, but we're not people. We decide what's normal for us. We can talk about it once we're safe, which, may I remind you, we are not." "We can't hide from them," Dawn said. "We ate. We did what we had to do. And we'll do more to stop what's coming." She recalled eyes among the stars, the thirst that drank worlds, the terror of that cold and infinite regard. "Can we beat them?" "Not like this. That man caught us in wire, whittled us down, and grew us like a tree in a bottle. I couldn't even fight those gods. We need leverage. I think I know where to find some. But I can't hold that cloud against the moon forever." "What happens when it goes away?" "You see the moon, and the moon sees you. And it doesn't like us very much. Now, move." "I can't." The serpent's eyes were cold and clear. "You can because you have to. The things that are after us have teeth, and the things ahead of us eat worlds. But we're in this together, and I won't let them win." It coiled down, inches from her face, its eyes fixed on hers. "Will you?" Dawn felt the serpent stare, the dare of a girl at the edge of a cliff above the ocean. She looked up and up into the space between the stars where the spiders spun their iron webs. No water anywhere was deeper than that. She could stay, kneel before the gods, apologize. She had been afraid, furious, flush with power. But Terra would want to fix her, stop her, and Terra's way was doomed. The spiders were coming. There was no time for committee meetings, for evidence or allies. A courtroom showdown wouldn't stop this. But Dawn could. Terra wanted to help her, to keep her safe. But the world needed more than safe. She tried to stand. Her vision swam. Falling, she reached out and felt smooth and cool scaled skin beneath her hand. Dawn asked, "Will you come with me?" The serpent descended. Great scaled flanks brushed her cheek, her neck, her shoulders. She braced herself for the weight, but it did not come. As the serpent coiled around her, it twisted into itself until it draped from her shoulders, as if she was a priestess in one of those books on Terra's bedside table, the kind where heroes had swords and weird names with apostrophes in them. The serpent's eyes were tiny jewels beside her own. "Can you walk?" Every step on this road led her away from Terra Abernathy. She stroked the cool black scales. "I can't keep calling you Serpent. Do you have a name?" Moonlight lined the cloud's eastern edge. "Perhaps," the serpent suggested, "we could settle issues of nomenclature when there are fewer ancient almighties out to kill us." "How about Sybil?" The serpent seemed to smile. "I can work with that." Dawn took her first step. The second was easier, and the third easier still, as if gravity pulled her forward instead of down. Sybil unclenched around her shoulders. Dawn had not realized just how afraid the serpent was. It made her seem almost human. "Where are we going, Sybil?" The serpent tasted the air and said, after a weighing silence, "South." 1. Caleb Altamach brought the blade to his skin. The donors were coming. The camp slept around him, silent, but for the rush of surf below the spire cliffs. The other tents, the great reclamation and replanting machines, the whole job site, might have been scooped up by a spirit's hand and carried off, leaving him alone before his basin. But he was not alone. The Ahayan mission of the Two Serpents group was out there, counting on him to do his job. He did not like to wake up this early, in the silver blue before dawn. When he was young, he had loved these hours. But back then he crept into them from the other direction, sometimes drunk, sometimes high, trailing poker hall fug. It had been a long time since he lived like that. Once, years back, he had waked to this deep stillness without the woman he'd gone to sleep beside. Mal had left him there on the waves and gone to kill a god. Early mornings were closer to each other than to the days that followed them. He felt as if he could slip through the silence between the years, a ghost haunting himself. It helped to shave and dress. The razor found his edges, lifted soap from his cheek and jaw, and left them smooth. His clothes would hide the deeper marks made by other blades. A loud crack broke the stillness, then a rumble and crash. He twitched, cut himself. He recognized the sound. A spire cliff had fallen. The cut on his jaw stung. His bad leg ached. He toweled off, plastered the cut, and reached for his cane. Tents hunched around him in the mist like sleeping beasts. Behind the olive canvas, he could hear others stirring, his colleagues, his employees. Teo had been trying to get him comfortable with that word for years. They were dressing now. Praying, those who prayed, waiting for teapots to boil, for water treatment pills to dissolve. Their rustling movements might have been sounds from the guts of tent beasts digesting. No alarm, no sentries, no screams. He was on edge, thinking about Mal. Spire cliffs collapsed all the time. Still, it never hurt to check. Scar tissue in his leg pulled as he walked to the edge of the cliff. He could still feel his old wounds most mornings, the pieces into which he had been broken, the scars his father had left him pulled to and ached before storms. But the pain in his leg just meant that he'd survived. Some days he did not need the cane. Some days he only needed it in the morning. He hoped this would be one of those days. Tail would tell him not to worry. Donors weren't investors, exactly. You didn't have to sell them the same slick image. They want to see care, she said. They want to see the mission. They want to be purified by our work. That's what their soul stuff buys. Or, if you don't like buying, say, that's what their wealth supports. You don't have to play the brilliant young sociopath for these people. Be tired and virtuous and hurt. Be the man who left it all on the court. Tao used sports metaphors more than she used to. In one of the tempestuous interludes in her relationship with Sam, the time they'd broken up after Kavekana, Tao had dated, well, had a fling with. Well, it was complicated, but she had been briefly with Talon. That Talon, the Ulamo player. They'd met in one of those thrown together by fortune on the run from the Zurich mob things, was how Tao explained it, though Caleb did not think that situation was common enough to be one of those things. When Tao told the story, she would finish her drink, she only ever told the story while drinking, and say, it was a weird, hot mistake, and I'm glad Sam and I worked our shit out, but it was a hell of a mistake. People took all sorts of souvenirs from relationships. From Mel, Caleb had his cane. From Talon, Tao had sports metaphors. At the cliff's edge, Caleb found Ortega. The old man leaned against his lance, staring out at the other basalt pillars upthrust from the sea. Here, far from the golf ball, the spires looked almost normal. A uniform 112 meters tall, black stone jutting from the gray wild waters of what the Askari who drew the maps had called the World Sea. No uncanny geometries in this rock, no faces, no black iron. Out here the cliffs did not change as you watched. Unsupported, sleek, they stood until they fell. Boss, Ortega pointed with his chin at a spire cliff they'd called Overbite because its top had flared with a tooth-like shelf of rock. Have to think up a new name. A fissure cut across Overbite, sharpening its pillar to a stake. The fallen rock shelf lay wave-lashed below. I should check it out, Caleb said. Donors here today. Can't be too careful. His leg ached at the thought of the stairs down to the wharf. Jody's on it, Ortega pointed again. Caleb saw the silver flash of a wingsuit circling. Still. A twitch of the old man's pitted cheek passed for a smile. He would have been a good poker player if he could draw better cards. Tao said, make sure he does his job, not yours. Let us work, hey? You made the Skellies pay what it will take to fix this mess. He nodded back toward the enormity of the site, toward the golf ball. I bet Jody thinks she has it easier. Ortega had come to them in their second year, a dour veteran of border wars in Southern Calf. Caleb did not know his past. Not that Ortega was a quiet man. He talked a lot. Told stories of love gone wrong, of mistakes with grenades, of duels and prison, of misadventures in every refugee camp and Box Canyon on the continent. But those stories never became a fabric. He never said where he was from, only that he had never fought for any government, nor bowed to any god, that his lance was always free. They'd met when Caleb was trying to heal an old God Wars battlefield on the Pampas. Ortega had been so amused by Caleb's claim that the Two Serpents group wanted to fix things that he stuck around. I have to see, he'd said, whether this is a trick, some new poison of control, so I can kill you if it is. Caleb had thought at the time that Ortega was joking. After prolonged acquaintance, he felt less sure. That was one reason Caleb liked him. Tell me if Jody finds anything. Game tonight? Ortega asked. As Caleb turned back, how much of your soul do you have left? Spent my whole life losing, boss. Shame to stop now. Caleb met the reporters by the Golem Wing deck. Six of them had come together in a van from Alt Tazel, locals in beat-up linen suits who'd been upset when Ortega told them they couldn't smoke in hazmat gear. He shook their proffered hands, the man from the Post and the man from the Telegraph, the woman from the Nightmare Wire, the chrome-masked revenant from the Thaumaturgist, and the shaved-headed society rag personage who, Caleb imagined, would have claimed that their own suit was not in fact beat up, but artfully distressed. Caleb spoke about the spire cliffs and the project. He was brief, because the reporters weren't interested. The group had worked in the spire cliffs for years, reclaiming soil inch by inch. The cliffs, even the golf ball, were known atrocities. There wasn't a story there. The reporters were here for the donor. So was he. As Caleb spoke, he noticed the sixth reporter, hard and nervous, and maybe 20. She stood apart from the nicotine fog of career journalism. Her eyes were bright blue, her gaze the dissecting kind. When his speech wrapped questionless and the others drifted to the coffee urn, she stayed. No one had bothered to introduce her. An assistant, maybe. Teo said, "Never overlook assistants. They keep planets in orbit and seasons in their course." He walked over. "You look like you want to ask something. It would make a nice change." She twitched, as if startled from a dream. Suddenly on guard, as if she hadn't believed anyone would see her. Over by the coffee urn, the woman from the Nightmare Wire chuckled at a joke she'd told. The man from the Post shook his head slowly. "I'm Caleb," he offered. He shifted to face the sea, to give her space.
Daniela, I didn't mean..."
"It's all right." Poor kid. He'd been like that early in his career at RKC. The only person in any room who hadn't killed at least a demigod in the wars. Early career was tough, particularly when late career folks tended not to die. "First big assignment?" She laughed, as if he'd said something funny, or bleak, or both.
"That's one way to put it."
"You'll do great. It might seem hard at first, but you'll find your way." She hesitated then.
"This project, the Two Serpents Group, you built it. You brought these people together. You're trying to heal..."
She turned, just a little, away from the golf ball and the deeper horrors of the cliffs.
"You're trying."
"I've been lucky," he said, "and I've had a lot of help. It's hard to do anything alone. Anything worth doing, I mean."
"Were you scared at the beginning?"
The question surprised him, though not so much as the answer. "No." He remembered the silence of waves and the absence of after. "Before the Two Serpents Group, it felt like my life was over, so I was free." She crossed her arms and looked away.
"It's never over."
He didn't know what that meant. He wanted to ask, but there was a mote in the rising sun, and then a pinprick, and then the mighty spread of metal wings. He put on his game face and climbed to meet the donor. Ever since the group's founding, Caleb had wondered, why did donors give? Teo thought the answer was simple. Donor relations were an issue of sales strategy, not so different from her old work at Red King Consolidated. The Two Serpents Group wanted to heal wounds and mend the broken. To do that, you needed funding. Who had funds? Deathless kings, consortiums, and concerns, those gods that were left. So those were the people, loosely speaking, that you asked. The problem was that most of those people, loosely speaking, had assembled their fortunes by causing the very damage the Two Serpents Group wanted to fix. If you were the sort of person who would kill a god in order to mine the necromantic earths beneath her holy mountain, would you really feel bad about the famine that followed, and the ghouls, and the wars and refugees caused by the famine and the ghouls? Would you feel bad enough to pay a large portion of your gains to fix what you had done? Maybe. Teo had said. Soul stuff might be fungible, but blood was sticky. Practically speaking, though, you didn't go to Dame Albin, despoiler of Zorgravia, and ask her to fund Zorgravia's recovery from said despoiling. You went to Ivan Karnoff, legitimate businessman, without any connection to Maskorovim soul trafficking in Iskar, and asked him to help the poor benighted people. Literally benighted, Dame Albin having murdered their sun goddess of Zorgravia, a region toward which Karnov's utterly legitimate business partners had a level of personal affection and territorial ambition. Then you went to Dame Alban and asked her to help you rescue victims of Maskorovim soul trafficking in Iskar, and so on. For Caleb, that math didn't check out. You still had to convince people to pay soul stuff that might otherwise go toward expanding their yacht collection on ventures that wouldn't benefit them personally. People who worried about the blood on their hands didn't end up eating off golden plates. It made sense, though, if you saw it as a poker table. Players came to the table for many reasons. Some wanted to win, to learn the game of odds and risks, of reading bodies across the green felt. Others played to greet the goddess, to impress a girl or a boy, to test themselves, to show off. There were even players who wanted to lose. They bought into hands they should have dodged. They chased bets they knew they couldn't win. Perhaps they wanted to show off all they had to lose. Perhaps they needed humiliation. Perhaps they wanted to pour themselves into the game and never be enough. To play well, you had to know why people played, and some players just wanted to pay. So when he met donors, he looked for the shakes. He looked for the widening of the eye or inclination of the head, the restless, betraying hands. The reason didn't matter, guilt or ambition or fear, even a plain desire to help. If they had the shakes, Caleb had something to work with. If not, he was left with fairy tales and sales strategy. Eberhard Jax did not shake. A Hatekef Golemwing brought him in from his yacht, along with his publicist and his PA, and three security guards in carbon weave pinstripe suits and wraparound shades. When Caleb closed his eyes to see the world of craft, Jax was a Nova. Beside him, the PA and publicist were wire-framed twists of soul stuff, and the security suits were not there at all. Stealth worked glyphs? He didn't know that was possible. But then, Eberhard Jax was not known for respecting the bounds of the possible. Jax did not look like someone who would need security. In a slim-cut blue-wool Talon Rose suit and white canvas sneakers, camel hair scarf draped over his shoulder, he had the wondering expression of the early morning bird watcher, alert to flashes of color in the canopy. Jax was young for a donor. Caleb was used to pitching deathless kings. Jax didn't just have skin in the game, he had literal skin. He was older than Caleb, though not by much, born of Shield Sea shipping barons and the cadet branch of some surviving post-Wards Ebonwald nobility, free of any chance of failure. What could someone like Jax want? Caleb wrote the morning off as a waste. Then Jax stepped onto the landing pad and changed. His eyes tightened, and his smile. His gaze flicked from Caleb to the twisted job site behind him, to the golf ball. He didn't have the shakes, but whatever this was, Caleb could work with it. Jax swept forward, hand out, smiling with teeth. "Mr. Altamach! A pleasure, Mr. Jax. Welcome to the end of the world." In glyphwork hazmat suits, they shuffled toward the golf ball. Caleb led, with Jax at his shoulder. Behind Caleb walked Ortega, his lance collapsed into a staff. Behind Jax, the three heavies. They refused to stay behind, so Ortega refused too. He would have pulled Jody and Sven off the security detail to bulk out their entourage if Caleb hadn't stopped him. In whose party were the journalists? Count them for Jax, probably. Jax had invited them. When Caleb said he must be glad to see so many, though, Jax had laughed. "I fear you misunderstand my relationship with the press." Jax did not seem like he feared much, except rhetorically. "Even scavengers may seek live prey in time of need. I feed them when I can, so they do not look for other meals." He waved to the reporters. A camera flashed. Caleb caught Daniela's eyes. She half-waved, a quick movement. "So you invite them," Caleb said, "when you have a secret to keep?" A tight smile played over the other man's thin lips. "How would you describe your goal here, Mr. Altamach? Land reclamation?" "That was the reason we were brought in at first. No one else could make headway." They crossed a steel bridge over a vast drop to the crashing ocean. Craftwork wards decayed within hours.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?